Tonight's scripture reading will be read from Genesis 37:1. Genesis 37:1. And Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan.
Well, back in Genesis chapter 15, God promised Abraham that his people would be in bondage about 400 years, and then they would come out and inherit that land, and they would come out from that land that enslaved them with great riches. But now we got to get the Israelites down into Egypt before we can get them up out. The way that God gets them down into Egypt is a great study, one of the greatest studies in the Bible, in providence. Genesis 37:1, Levi read for us. Genesis 37:2 begins, "This is the history of Jacob." And Genesis 37 through 50 is pretty much about Joseph, but it's about getting Jacob, or the people of Israel, because his name was changed to Israel, down into Egypt. Before the Bible was outlined with chapters and verses, God had his own system of outlining at least some books. The book of Genesis was one of those. When you see in the book of Genesis, "This is the history of," or in some places, "This is the genealogy of," the Hebrew word is toledoth. I'm not sure if I pronounced that correctly or not. You see it in Genesis 2, verse 4. "This is the history of the heavens and the earth." You see it in Genesis 5, verse 1. "This is the genealogy of Adam." You see it in Genesis 6, verse 9. "This is the genealogy of Noah." You see it in Genesis 10, verse 1, Genesis 11, verse 10, and then Genesis 11, verse 27 about the genealogy of Terah. What it is doing is dividing up the histories of those particular genealogical characters that lead us to the Christ. Well, this is the last of the 10 genealogical sections in the book of Genesis, the last toledoth, if you will. And you probably have known the story from childhood. Remember that Joseph is one son of 12. There are four mothers involved in those 12 sons. Joseph's mother was Rachel, who was his father's favorite. Joseph becomes a favorite over all the other brothers to his father, and his father should have known better than to play favorites, because his parents did with him, and that's what cost so much back at that time. Joseph also doesn't learn the lesson, and he flaunts this kind of favoritism in the face of his brothers. I don't blame him too much. He was only 17 years old at this time. I had no clue what I was doing when I was 17 years old. I could barely brush my hair, which I had at that time. But I still don't have much clue at 59, but at least maybe I've learned a few things. But Joseph would hear his brothers telling stories, and he'd essentially go be a tattletale on them. On top of that, he had the coat of many colors, which showed that his father favored him. His brothers got very angry at this, and they plotted to murder him. Reuben, the oldest, steps in and says, "Let's not murder him, let's sell him into slavery. At least we could have some profit that way." And Judah helps along the line as well. Ishmaelite traders come along. Midianite traders come along. How the two were exactly connected, we don't know. But we'll know this: if Abraham had stuck to God's plan for one wife and listened to God's promise all the way through, there wouldn't be any Ishmaelites, and there wouldn't be any Midianites. The Ishmaelites came as a result of Hagar and Abraham's union, and the Midianites came along when Abraham took another wife, Keturah, and had several sons by her, one of whom was Midian. Well, these Ishmaelites and Midianites come along, and they are there to purchase Joseph and then go on and sell him into slavery in Egypt. You find then that he'll be in Potiphar's house. And Potiphar was a high-ranking official, a captain of the guard. But then there's an interruption. The story doesn't flow from Potiphar's house at the end of chapter 37 till the beginning of chapter 39. And in between, there's a very sordid tale of immorality and law-breaking that's stuck in there about the third son of Jacob by Leah, and that was Judah. Judah had three sons, Onan, and Shelah, by this time. Was wicked before the Lord, and so God killed him. That's all we know about that. Onan took his place. It would later be law in the Israelite law, in the law of Moses, that if a brother died, then the next oldest brother would marry that brother's widow. And if that brother died, the next oldest brother would marry that brother's widow in order to raise up a name for his brother. That was the custom at the time before the law of Moses as well. So Onan is supposed to go in to Ur's wife and raise up children by her, but Onan cheats. And if you're old enough to read the scriptures and understand what I'm saying, you know what I'm saying. And so that caused him to be taken out of the picture as well. And then Tamar, the wife of the first two, has to wait. Judah says to her, wait till Shelah is grown, and then you can have him for a husband. But Tamar apparently waits and waits. Remember, time passes in the Bible in a sentence just like that. And apparently Shelah is grown, and there's no sign of Judah giving him to her in marriage. And so she takes matters into her own hands. She goes and dresses like a harlot and plays the part. And Judah is looking for a harlot one night and goes into her, promising her that he'll pay her for her services. She requests that before the payment be made, she has his signet and his cord. That's kind of like asking for your driver's license today. I'll pay you something later. Well, what can I have to be sure you're going to pay me? Well, give me your driver's license. That's essentially what she did. And then later someone comes and says, Tamar is with child. And Judah is angry and wants her put to death until he finds out that his driver's license that she has, his cord and signet that she has, and then she has twins. She has Perez and Zerah. Zerah starts to come out first, but then Perez breaks through, and that's what his name means, and he comes out first. And you wonder why this story is here. Well, if you match up the genealogies in Genesis to the genealogy in Luke chapter 3 from Jesus all the way back to Adam, here's what you have. Adam, Seth, Enosh, Canaan, Mahalalel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, Noah, Shem, Arphaxad, Salah, Eber, Peleg, Reu, Sarug, Nahor, Terah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, Perez is the next in the line of Christ. So that story's got to be there to tell us how he got into the line of Christ. People draw all kinds of lessons about some of the people that are in the line of Christ. We'll later find out that there was a harlot in the line of Christ. We'll later find out that there were some Gentiles in the line of Christ. And I think maybe the lesson for us to gain is that God didn't set up something so pristine that real human beings weren't involved. God took real human beings and sanctified the process to make sure that Jesus got into the world. Well, back in chapter 39, then Potiphar is at issue. Potiphar is a busy man. He's out all day. His wife is a woman of ease, a kept woman, you might say. And she is at home all day while Joseph takes care of matters. Joseph was sold as a slave, but the Lord was with him. That's the recurring theme. Because Joseph continues to be an obedient person. The only thing that I have against Joseph is that he, at 17 years old, was tattling against his brothers, and he was the favorite child. Well, one of those he couldn't control. The other one, he was just being immature. But the rest of the time, as my son put it the other night, what a breath of fresh air compared to all the wicked characters that we've seen so far, whom God worked through anyway to get to his appointed means, or his appointed son. Now Joseph then is faithful, and Joseph works hard. He has a good work ethic. He rises to prominence in Potiphar's house so that Potiphar, in his whole estate, he's not just running a two-person household, a four-person household. He's running an estate with servants and all these sort of things like that, a rich man's estate. But Joseph is the one running it, and Potiphar only knows the meals that he eats. But Potiphar's wife sees that Joseph is handsome. The Bible doesn't tell us how beautiful Potiphar's wife might have been. It doesn't tell us how tempted Joseph might have been. But we know that the temptation was there, and we know that it was constant. Read carefully. I forget the exact verses right now, but read carefully. She kept saying to him, she kept asking him to lie with her. This wasn't just a one-time occasion. She pressed him day by day. Can you imagine going to work every day and someone there every day is trying to get you to commit fornication and sin against your God? Well, that was Joseph's plight, and he held up well. Until one day, she decided that she would have her vengeance when he refused her advances. and he left his coat because he had to leave quickly and run from her to get out of the temptation situation, which leads to the lesson in 1 Corinthians 6, verse 18, flee, run from sexual immorality. Joseph literally did that, and it literally cost him his freedom. Potiphar came home, and Potiphar's wife had concocted this story of sexual harassment, the kind of thing that's still used today against public characters, and we never know if it's true or not true. Well, Potiphar's wife didn't know if it was true, or Potiphar didn't know if it was true or not true. So he had Joseph committed to prison. Some people suggest that Potiphar kind of believed Joseph, because in that culture, Joseph would likely have been put to death for making advances on Potiphar's wife. But perhaps Potiphar had a little bit of mercy, thinking, yeah, I know how my wife is, and this may not all add up. So he only committed Joseph to prison instead of putting him to death. The Bible doesn't say that. The Bible doesn't say exactly what took place in Potiphar's mind. We only know what he did, and he put Joseph in prison for it. Well, Joseph was in prison there, and the Lord was with him there as well, and he rose to the top of the prison hierarchy, if you will. The keeper of the prison left everything in Joseph's charge. Do you see a pattern here? Joseph is going to be first at home. He's going to be second in Potiphar's household. He's going to be second in prison. And he's going to be second in all the land of Egypt at some point. And it takes a man of great character, number one, to be of power, but not let it go to his head. Joseph never seems to have let it go to his head. And number two, to take a man on the opposite side of things who's willing to play second fiddle and plays it well. Joseph is a man of great character, breath of fresh air. Joseph rises to the second in command in the keeper of the prison, with the keeper of the prison. And there are a couple of dreams that are had. You know the dreams that were had in chapter 37. The only intervention that God does in this whole story to get his people from Canaan down to Egypt, the only intervention is dreams. The rest of it just takes place behind the scenes. There is no miraculous. There's no voice. There's no statement. It's just that they have dreams. And Joseph is the one who's able to interpret them correctly. Well, Joseph had the dreams that indicated his brothers and his mother and father would bow down to him in chapter 37. That's what got him so angry in the first place. And now the butler and the baker have these dreams. The butler's dream means that he'll be reinstated to his position in 3 days. The baker's dream means that he'll be put to death in 3 days. So Joseph tells them the dream and then begs the butler, remember me when you get out of here and tell Pharaoh about me so that I can get out of prison. Well, the butler gets out. He forgets for 2 years until Pharaoh has dreams. When Pharaoh has dreams, his dreams are of seven fully fed, plump cows coming out of the river. Also seven thin and ugly cows, gaunt cows coming out of the river. The thin and ugly gaunt ones eat the plump ones, but they're no fatter. He has the same kind of dream with stalks of grain. Purposefully, two dreams. Pharaoh doesn't know how to interpret these dreams. Dream interpretation was a big thing back then. Today, if we tried to interpret dreams, I don't know where we'd go with that, but it was a big thing, especially for leaders at that time, who always wanted to try to look into the future and see a little bit about what might be coming. And we've had presidents and presidents' wives who fell into that category, to some degree, ourselves. Well, Pharaoh calls all the magicians of the land, and he still can't find out what's going to go on from these dreams until the butler remembers, oh yes, there was this man in prison who knew how to interpret dreams, and that was Joseph. So he gets Joseph and brings him up and appears before him. And Joseph tells him what the dreams mean. There will be 7 years of plenty. During those 7 years of plenty, get ready, because there are going to be 7 years of famine. During the 7 years of plenty, save up all the grain you can, because there are going to be 7 years of famine. And I advise the king to put somebody in charge of storing up that food that'll do a good enough job, because he knows those 7 years of famine are coming. And the king says, well, who else would we have but Joseph to do that? So now Joseph is second in all the land of Egypt, second only to Pharaoh. It's a couple years into the years of plenty. I'm sorry, a couple years into the years of famine. A couple years into the years of famine, when we find out that Joseph's brothers realize that their family is going to get hungry really soon. Now, I don't know how famine works. I've never been through it, but I've seen how societal shifts work and how things, how inflation works and things like that. And it's not just like somebody turns a switch and, oh, we have a famine today and we don't have a famine tomorrow. It takes time for the crops to fizzle out and for people to huddle with what they have, and then finally it gives out and this family borrows from that family. So the famine probably was spreading to Canaan as we go, and finally Jacob sees we don't have any food left. At least we're running really low. They're not running completely out, because when he sends his brother, sends his sons down there to get food, he sends gifts, and some of them involve some food. But he's given his finest food, hoping to try to get some sustaining food for his family back in Canaan. So Jacob sends his brothers down to Egypt because he's heard there's food there. The brothers, can you just imagine the drama of the scene? Appear before Joseph. Joseph knows exactly who they are. They don't know who he is. He peppers them with questions. Somebody might say he's having a little bit of fun with them, but I doubt it was too much fun. There are too many instances of Joseph crying in all of this. He peppers them with questions to try to find out. He doesn't know if they might be liars. Doesn't know what their motive might be. You could probably assume the best, that they're coming genuinely for food. But he accuses them of being spies. Well, you guys are spies, and I'm not going to trust you. Well, no, we're just the sons of one father in particular. Who's your father? Tell me about him. And do you have any more brothers? Because Benjamin wasn't there, and Benjamin had been born to Rachel as well, and she died in childbirth. Do you have any brothers? So they told him all about that. He said, here's what you have to do. All of you stay here, and one of you go back and bring them down. Well, that sits with them for a few days while they wait in prison. And then he changes his demand. He keeps Simeon and sends the rest of the brothers back. He sends them back with their sacks full of grain. And then he does this benevolent move of having their money that they brought for the food put back in their sacks. And they don't know that. Till on the way home, one of them finds the money in his sack when he sets it down to get something out of it. They're very distressed about that. Oh no, we've stolen this much from Pharaoh. We'll never be able to get more food again. But all they know to do is go home. They go home. When they all open their sacks, then all their money is there. They're really distressed about that. And then they realize that when they have to go back, they have to take Benjamin with them, because that's been Joseph's decree. And Dad says Benjamin's not going. Well, things just wait for a little bit. What do you do when you have, when you're at an impasse like that? You eat. You sustain life. You just keep moving. And they did. Till they started to run low again. And Jacob says, you boys go down to Egypt and get some food. We can't, Dad. He told us he's not going to see us unless we bring Benjamin. Well, you're not taking Benjamin. Well, then we're not going, Dad. One of them steps up and says, let me be collateral for him. But he won't let Benjamin go at first. He finally relents and says, if Benjamin doesn't come back, I've already lost Joseph. I've already lost Rachel. If Benjamin doesn't come back, you'll bring down, this is a tragic phrase, you'll bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave. I won't get to enjoy the rest of my days. So they go with that, and they take Benjamin in. When they get close, I forget exactly how, I've always had trouble with these chapters, 43 and 44, exactly the order of transpiration of events. But these things, I know, happen at some point. They stand before Joseph. Joseph has to leave because he wants to cry when he sees Benjamin. He sends them on their way again, and this time puts the money back in the sacks, and this time tells his steward to put his finest cup in Benjamin's sack. And then he tells his steward, after they've gone a little bit, now go find these fellows and search for the cup. And when the cup is found, you bring them back to me. And when the cup is found, you say, did you not know that my master can practice divination? This is the cup with which he practices divination. Now, I've said the only problem that I have with Joseph is back when he was 17. If he practiced divination, that's a problem. I'm not sure that he did. I think maybe he's just putting a little fear into them. Don't you know that if you take something from me, I'm going to know it? because divination, sorcery was a practical thing back then that they tried to do. I think it was all fake. And then the other problem we might have is if Joseph is saying he's doing that and he's not, then he's lying. This might be the only other problem. But other than that, we see a man of great character. And you think, well, how could a man with a problem like that be called a great character? I hope that I'm allowed into heaven, even with the flaws that I have, that I've tried to work on through the years. Not that I continue to sin that grace may abound. No, no, no. But I think you know what I mean. So Joseph is going to have the cup of divination found. They find it in Benjamin's sack. He says, Benjamin's got to stay with me. Finally, they get to the point that they're all before him. Joseph has everybody go out from him, and he wept aloud in their presence and told them, I'm Joseph, your brother. Then you can hear all their jaws hit the floor with an anvil inside it, you know, clunk, like you see in the cartoons. They don't know what's going on. They don't know what to expect. And one of them says, we're getting our just due. We're getting everything that's due to us because we listened to his cries when he was in the pit. And that shed some light on chapter 37. They put Joseph in the pit, then they sat down to eat a meal. Apparently, they could hear Joseph's cries from the pit, and yet they just sat there eating the meal with callousness of heart. And finally, Joseph moves all his family down into Canaan so that they can be safe from the famine. He gets Pharaoh's permission, tells them they're shepherds, they have meals together. This gets the children of Israel down into Egypt. And it all works out for good. But for 22 years, Joseph didn't have a clue. All he had for 22 years was, hold on to God, trust him. For 22, how do we know it was 22 years? Well, he was 17 when he was taken in Genesis 37. In, I think it's chapter 41, verse 46, or somewhere around there. He's 30 years old when he appears. And then after that, it's 7 years of plenty plus 2 years into the famine that he sees his brothers. So 9 plus the 17 is 26 plus the 10. I did the math wrong, but it's been 22 years. I've got it in writing somewhere. You do the math, it's 22 years that he's seen. And how long does it take for a man to get discouraged? He's been in Potiphar's house, goes to prison. If I'd have just committed that with her, then I wouldn't. But he kept faithful through all those years as part of God's plan to get Israel down into Egypt so that he could bring him up out of Egypt in order to show his great wonders to the world. The book of Exodus starts with a Pharaoh that does not remember Joseph. So a Pharaoh comes along in the course of the hundreds of years that doesn't remember Joseph, doesn't have any regard for the people of Israel, and enslaves the people of Israel, makes their slavery rather difficult, and the slavery becomes harder because the Egyptians become afraid of them. We think that these people are going to rise up. They're going to have enough baby boys to raise up a great army and come against us. So Pharaoh says to the midwives, apparently I envision the head midwives of all the midwives in all of Egypt, Shiphrah and Puah, when the Israelites give birth on their birth stools, if it's a baby girl, you let her live, and if it's a baby boy, you kill him. But the Bible says that Shiphrah and Puah feared God, and therefore did not do that, and God rewarded them for that. Now there's a lot of controversy then about their lie, because they say, well, you know, we get to the Israelite ladies, and they've already given birth when we get there. And once again, I would simply interject. That's a long discussion we could have at another time. But I would simply interject. Here are pagan women from a pagan country standing up to the king of the world. If they get one thing wrong, how many things wrong might I get if I were trying to do right in that situation? Might God have some mercy on them? And then, finally, Moses is born during that conflagration. And the mothers themselves are supposed to take the babies and baby boys and throw them in the river if they've been born. But Moses' mother goes the extra mile. They saw that he was a beautiful child. I don't know that I've ever seen an ugly child, but he saw that he was a beautiful child. And she made an ark of bulrushes and put it on the river and put Moses in that and just set the baby there and trust it in God. How hard would that be for a mother to do? Well, the baby floats down the river, and Pharaoh's daughter, with her entourage, comes to the river, finds the baby. And then in one of the great, almost humorous acts of providence in all the Bible, here's Moses' sister somewhere, I envision, up on a hill, who says down to Pharaoh's daughter, seeing the complexity of what's going on in her head, Pharaoh's daughter wants to keep the baby, but she can't run out to the store and buy formula, and she can't run out and buy everything that she needs, even though she's rich. Somebody's got to nurse that baby. The sister says, "Would you like me to get one of the Hebrew women to nurse this baby for you?" Pharaoh's daughter says, "Yes, that's a great idea." So Moses' sister gets Moses' mother to raise Moses in the Egyptian household and probably get paid for raising him. Moses has then learned in all the ways of the Egyptians. He's learned in all the ways of the Hebrews. Raised by an Egyptian mother, raised by a Hebrew mother. When it comes time to send a diplomat to get the Israelites out of Egypt, here's the Israelite Moses, who's also the Egyptian Moses, and knows how to work in between the two. God's foreknowledge makes great things happen, even without the miraculous. Well, Moses reaches 40 years old, and he chooses, according to the book of Hebrews, to suffer affliction with the people of God rather than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin for a season. He stands up for his brethren. One of the Hebrews is being beaten, and he stands up and kills the man that's being beaten. He finds his body in the sand. Doesn't think anybody knows about it. I don't know about the killing. The Bible doesn't comment about the killing. And then the next day, he tries to break up a fight between two of his Hebrew brethren, and they say, "Who are you to judge between us? You going to kill us like you did him?" And all I know is that the Bible says those things happened. And then I know that Moses ran. And he was away for 40 years. So Joseph had to wait 22 years to figure out what was going on. Moses grew to the age of 40 and then ran. You're still in pretty good health at age 40, especially for when you live to be 175 like Abraham, or 120 like Moses did, rather. And then at 80 years old, he's in Midian. He's had children there. He's had a family there. He sees a burning bush. He goes aside to see what this bush is. It's the appearance of the Lord. I am who I am. The Lord identifies himself. You're going to go lead the children of Israel out of Egypt. I am not, Moses essentially says. He uses five different excuses to try to get out of the responsibility. How's God going to judge that in judgment day? I don't know. He uses five different excuses to try to get out of leading the children of Israel, the last one of which is just send somebody else. God says, "Okay, Aaron will be your spokesman, but you're going. You've been prepared for this moment, and you're going. What if they don't believe me?" Well, you know the answers. Throw down that rod, it turns into a snake. Pick up that rod, turns back. Pick up that snake, turns back into a rod. What if they don't believe me? I'll be with you. God gives him every assurance. So Moses and Aaron go to the ruler of the world's greatest empire of the time, and one of the greatest empires of history, to say, "Let my people go. The Lord has said, let my people go." "Well, who is the Lord that I should obey him?" Pharaoh says. And so they work a few of those miracles. And those miracles don't convince Pharaoh. And so the act is done that God says to do, that causes all the water in the land to turn into blood. What was occurring to me the other day? I was talking with Andrew about this, and I was thinking, you know, it's one thing for God to get Israel down into Egypt with just 70 people, that's how many they had, with some dreams and Joseph. But getting them down into Egypt wasn't the promise. The promise was that they would come up out of Egypt. And how's God going to do that? He's going to do it so that all his power is known over all the people of the earth, over all the natural calamities of the earth, over the natural phenomena of the earth, over all the gods that they had in Egypt. God's going to make sure Everybody knows. And he made it work, didn't he? We're still talking about it some 4,000 years later. The first of those 10 plagues that would rattle the world forever was that all the water turned into blood. The people started digging, looking for wells. Where are we going to find? Now, if you're an Egyptian at that time, you're not in a democracy where you're usually having protests, and you're not in a republic where you usually can gather and protest the government. But you know, you might be thinking at this point, what's wrong with Pharaoh? And by the end of the time, by the end of the 10 plagues, they're going to be saying to the Hebrews, go. I don't care what he says, just go. Now Pharaoh would let them go, but they're to the point, just go. Here, take our stuff, take my kitchenware, take my jewelry, take my stuff, just go. Because God's power always comes through when God promises something to be done. Lessons learned from these chapters, Genesis 37 through Exodus 7. Trust God. He knows what's happening 22 years ahead of time, 80 years ahead of time, 120 years ahead of time. Trust God. Obey God's principles. Obey God's morality. Do the very best you can in difficult situations. Shipra and Pua did the very best they could, I think, in a difficult situation. And they were rewarded for it. And always know that God will work His will. All of this was a part of the plan to get us past Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, Perez, to Ram, Abinadab, Nahshon, Boaz, Obed, Jesse, David, all the way down the line to Christ. And God made sure that everybody knew it. Today, God's will is that you become a Christian. All of these grand things that God did in history culminate for an individual when that individual yields himself to Christ and yields to the waters of baptism, meets the blood of Christ there in a figure, is raised to walk in newness of life. That very act that we witness sometimes in this baptistry, or that people have witnessed in creeks and rivers throughout history, that culminates all the history of God that He had planned so that people could be saved and be a part of His church. If you've not done that tonight, we pray you would. If you've been unfaithful to God, we pray you'd come back. He has all power. Trust Him. If we could help you, would you please come as we stand and sing?